This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Now we move on to a working example of climate journalism. That is Andy Revkin of the New York Times. For 14 years, our next guest was the environment reporter for one of the world's biggest newspapers, the New York Times. As global warming hit the charts and minds of this generation, Andy Revkin rode the whirlwind. He reported from the Arctic, from climate conferences, about a mass of scientific advances, and some social retreats. All the while, Andy kept his readers' eyes on another big bouncing ball, the continuous expansion of human population, and what that means for the wild world. Andy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
To start off, why did you leave the New York Times as a full-time journalist while you were at the top?
Well, there were a few things that were percolating for several years. One was, you know, if you do something for a long period of time, you start to reflect on whether you're using your time and skills to the best advantage. And I had been doing a lot of reporting on this sort of the sociological side of environmental challenges and realized increasingly that just writing about them, even doing writing about them effectively, probably wouldn't change things, especially on an issue that's as polarized as climate. So I just had dug in on that literature and realized I'm not working at both ends of the pipeline. In other words, writing is important, communicating is important, but also understanding how people receive information and how do you make information matter, that's also important. So that pulled me toward academia. And then the Times, in this real tough world of ours is shrinking the newsroom, and they offered in 2009 they had to get rid of 100 newsroom jobs. First time in close to 160 years they had to shrink the newsroom, and I took one of their offers of a buyout package to leave, and I still continue to write every day, of course, on .earth.
Right, and they've moved your blog, .earth, to the opinion side of the page. Does that give you more freedom to write?
It's an interesting transition. I talked to some of my friends who've made that transition, like Nick Kristoff, and it takes some time to get used to. It gives me more freedom when I really think there's something I can engage, where I have something to say that's my own conception of how the world works or doesn't work, so I can opine when I want to. But mostly the blog, .earth, is still an interrogatory thing. It's an exploratory form of journalism where I'm usually not telling you what to think or how I think, but I'm telling you this is my journey. I'm on a learning journey here. Come along with me.
I think a lot of reporting has become more personalized, perhaps because of the Internet. We want to know what are the emotions involved and what should we think. And along those lines, do you think the nuclear disaster in Japan is a game changer or just another disaster story?
It's more than just a disaster story, for sure, because it has huge ripple effects for the nuclear industry, which already, you know, the main constraints on rapid expansion of nuclear were financial. But a big chunk of the financial impediments there were related to community and distrust, and not just, you know, the actual cost of the bricks and the concrete and the titanium, but the cost of making sure that a community is convinced that this is something they want nearby. And that's really hard to do. So it's clear that whatever the issues that industry already faced for expansion are much greater now, and that makes it a big deal. And by the way, I was writing a lot recently about this in terms of the perceptions of hazard versus, you know, the actual hazard as well. And it's interesting, it's really divided the environmental community profoundly.
It has indeed, with people like Monbiot and Stuart Brand saying, well, this just shows us we need more nuclear, and other people going, oh, that can't be right. I wonder whether that split in the Greens is actually going to harm the movement.
Well, the movement already is going through some very severe growing pains. Most of the 20th century history of the environmental movement built around direct problems you could see and perceive and had a framing that usually was pointing the finger at somebody like a big oil company or a politician. So there was a woe is me and a shame on you aspect to almost everything. And with the issues we face in this century, it's much harder to point at, say, an Exxon as the bad guy when we're the ones lining up to buy the gasoline and the heating oil, which I still have to rely on. I don't want to rely on it, but it's the reality in where I live in the Hudson River Valley. So what I've been trying to do is, on the blog also, is explore new ways of building a movement that would actually matter in a world heading toward 9 billion people, roughly, seeking decent lives. What would that actually look like? And it doesn't really look like a traditional environmental approach is the best approach.
It seems to me at the New York Times you were stuck in the middle. Big Oil thought you went too far, perhaps, and some environmentalists said you didn't go far enough. Did you feel some pressure from your editors and from the public? Did you even get some death threats?
I got some weird phone messages and emails, but after a certain Rush Limbaugh went after me on his radio show, and this was related to population. I had done some discussion on the blog and then on a video conference on the reality that if you care about something like global climate change, you have to really deeply consider the population side of the equation. This is not just about consumption of the number of people, and in multiple ways, the number of people in harm's way from the risks of global warming is going up rapidly in poor places. And the United States population is heading toward 400 million or more, and that's important to consider. And he kind of said, well, if you think people are the worst thing that ever happened to this planet, why don't you just go kill yourself and save the planet by dying? Which was an interesting thing to say to 15 million people on the radio. But that's not the, you know, yeah, I've been kind of criticized off and on by both left and right. And I don't know whether it's my familial stance as a middle child, but I do tend to see in many, many cases, not everyone, that they're, that too much of our arguments these days are sort of waged from the edges. And when you do that, there's a lot of overstatement. Hoax catastrophe are words that were thrown around a lot in relation to climate change, and neither is really the way, if a strict interpretation of the issues doesn't come close to either, unless you have a really long time scale on the catastrophe side. And the reality is we don't have energy options we need. And so we miss the consensus too often in having polarized discourse. So I'm stuck in that middle, and I'll probably stay there.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is one of the premier environmental writers, former New York Times environmental reporter, now a blogger for that paper, Andy Revkin. Andy, population is such a hot-button issue in most of the world and in the States. We don't want to talk about it sometimes, but you do. Why is population so important to you, and why is it hard to write about?
Population is important just when you look at the trajectories of where we're headed, where we've been and where we're headed. It's just stunning, first of all, just to consider the human journey the last 200 years and the next 50. We were at 1 billion people on the entire planet in the year 1800. Now there are a billion teenagers, just teenagers, and there's a billion more kids below them, and there are a growing number of older people, too. We're heading toward a world of that's both young and old in ways that haven't happened before. But just that sheer explosive growth on its own is so remarkable that it has to be examined carefully. And then how that moves from being a spike to being something flatter, which is what's happening toward the middle of the century by almost every projection, at least for a while, how that transition looks. Is it a jagged kind of a curve, or is it a smoothish curve? That's where I really find myself focusing a lot. You know, how can you smooth our trajectory toward a more modulated relationship with the planet in the middle of the century in ways that, you know, how do you do that with the fewest regrets? And that's kind of the focal point of my blog. And, of course, you can't even have that conversation without talking about numbers. And so that's why I go there.
Yeah, you know, I think you just mentioned, or I read in your blog, that we're going to add the equivalent of another two Chinas.
Yeah, that's one way to add up the numbers. And many of the newcomers will be in India. India will be, by 2050, the China that we see today is more likely to be India at that time, just in terms of numbers and also where it's at and its growth of resource use and that kind of thing.
Andy, I just recorded a speech by Bill McKibben of 350.org and responding to an audience question about population. McKibben said that isn't the real driver of climate change because most of the new bodies on Earth arrive, as you say, in countries which produce so little carbon per capita compared to Western-style consumers. Your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, the per capita, and you have to look at emissions per person and the disparities around the world. And by the way, this isn't just, there are two worlds right now. There are two human experiences right now. There's the experience of those of us who live in industrialized countries where energy is a yawn, where you don't even think about it. It's really a small part of your monthly costs, even though it feels big when you fill up your gas tank. And then there's those around the world, 2 billion plus, who don't have an electric outlet, don't have anything that's a source of illumination, and don't have something to cook on other than a guttering unvented stove. So that, again, for any questions about climate policy, you end up with this fundamental need to consider the two worlds that are out there. That's something I try to hammer quite a bit. And the expectation that somehow or other, even a fast-growing developing country has the same obligation to cut its emissions of greenhouse gases as a mature one is not tenable. And that's pretty clear when you look at the climate negotiations that they're not going to do that unless we somehow pay for it. And it's quite clear that's not going to happen, too. There's a powerful and healthy future for environmental communication. Now, the subset of communication called journalism is already in a rapid state of evolution where there's community-generated reporting, there's nonprofit models, ProPublica and the Center for Public Integrity, and then there's the traditionals, the New York Times and BBC, CNN, and the like. Environmental journalism is still a going concern. You've seen that in coverage of hydrofracking and aspects of the energy problems revealed, you know, by what happened in Japan and the saturation coverage, not just by the New York Times, but by many local newspapers last year after the Gulf oil spill happened, the New Orleans paper, the papers all along the Gulf Coast did really marvelous reporting on that problem. And so I don't see it going away. I do see it changing in big ways, and I do think that journalism generally will be a shrinking part of a really explosively growing pie of how we share information and assess it. And I think the more that newspapers and other traditional forms of journalism get comfortable with some of the new approaches, including the kind of blogging that I do is not traditional blogging, but it's a way to examine an issue in an open-ended forum that has a trajectory, but that isn't every day trying to tell you, this is what we learned today. The days of Walter Cronkite signing off on his news broadcast that I grew up with, you know, that's the way it is. That's gone away anyway, so... because it was always kind of a faux, an overstated sense of that's the way the world really is. So it's all in flux. I think that means there's great opportunities for people to become communicators. There's also bigger responsibilities for scientists and their institutions to get more in the game directly, too.
Yeah, I really agree with you there. And, you know, I love all the links and the references and the videos you post. I found more than a few guests for Radio Wikushak from things that you've written about in the New York Times. Can you tell us how you work? Do you call people? Are people calling you? Are you surfing like the rest of us? How do you put this core information together for us?
Oh, it's a constant struggle, and I'm always missing stuff. I feel completely inadequate and would like to build out more of a community-created thing that's sort of like Dot Earth because the fire hoses are all on continually. And so quite often I'm literally grasping for little links, insights that are flowing by in this stream that are very hard to sift with a kind of in a reliable way to some extent. And I'd like to think I could get it more manageable. But the part of the challenge is, of course, I set myself a pretty broad question as the framing question of Dot Earth, which is, you know, how do we head toward roughly 9 billion people with the fewest regrets? So it spills into food, water, energy, conflict, poverty alleviation, sanitation. So that's a lot of fire hoses. And I wish, again, there was a way to take the power of the crowd and build out a kind of a broader version of what I do. And that's something I'm working on at Pace University, where that's where I have my academic post.
That's happening to a certain degree just from the high level of comments that I found on your blog.
They're mostly productive comments. There's some people who are there to spout, and they're always bringing me insights, some aspect of some issue that I hadn't thought of. And so several times on the blog, I've called myself a selfish blogger because I feel like I'm getting an awful lot out of it myself. Again, this is not a bully pulpit in that sense for me. It's mainly a place where I'm having a public journey.
As we wrap up, Andy, is there something you'd like to add for our listeners?
Well, just that I hope they'll dive in and check it out. It's the easiest way to find Dot Earth is just Google for the name Revkin, R-E-V-K-I-N. Once you check in, I think you'll find it pretty interesting. The other thing, of course, the Times has now a subscription wall that comes if you come to the site too frequently, but they have ways around that, especially if you come to Dot Earth via a link from Twitter, and I'm on Twitter as Revkin. There's a Dot Earth Twitter thing. So if you track it on Facebook or on Twitter, you'll keep coming to it that way, then you can avoid some of that issue as well.
There's some good advice. Andy Revkin has reached millions of minds for many years as one of the best environmental reporters in the world for the New York Times. His Dot Earth blog still appears in those pages. I have it bookmarked. You should, too. Just Google Andy Revkin, and his blog is at the top of the pile, as he says. Andy, thank you for sharing your time with us over all these years.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.